Journalist Faye Flam interviewed risk communication expert Peter M. Sandman on March 3, 2021, about his top gripes about how public health professionals are communicating COVID-19 risk. This is Segment 6, What We Get Instead of Respectful Tentative Debate. For the other segments, the complete 2-hour interview, or other content on coronavirus risk communication, go to www.psandman.com.
Let's also talk about increasing expert intolerance of minority opinions and even censorship of those opinions. I know there was an interesting article in Scientific American called The Science Wars about how people in public health who didn't agree with the extreme pessimism were being canceled, censored, you know, shut out of the argument.
I think there are at least four patterns, and this sort of, I mean, the underlying reality is the reluctance to acknowledge uncertainty. What we ideally would have is experts saying much of the time something like this, we don't yet have good data on X. We don't yet know with any clarity the answer to the X question. My opinion, as an expert having looked at the data, is that, you know, when the dust settles, the answer is probably going to look something like this. But my opinion is only my opinion. The data aren't very good yet. And I have colleagues every bit as knowledgeable as I am who have a different opinion. And in fact, if you want me to, I'll tell you what their opinion is too. That's ideal. You know, it's acknowledging the uncertainty. It's being willing to express an opinion despite the uncertainty, and it's being tolerant of the existence of alternative opinions among people who are just as expert as you are. You know, that's the right way, the ideal way for science to make progress in the face of a new pathogen about which very little is known. That's what we should have seen, or what we would have ideally seen. What we saw instead, it seems to me, is four different patterns. And it may be worth actually going through all four.
Yeah.
The first pattern is overconfident consensus. Most of the experts genuinely agree, but they agree prematurely. They agree without much grounds for their confidence. So that there was a time when virtually all experts said masks are pointless. You know, you don't need masks in everyday life. And virtually all experts supported lockdowns last March, even in places that had practically no spread of the virus. So there was a consensus. It wasn't a fake consensus. It was a genuine consensus or near consensus, but it was much more confident than the data justified. That's the first pattern. The second pattern is widespread disagreement. Both sides are communicating and they're pretending the other side doesn't exist. And a nice example of that is the wisdom of taking NSAIDs before and after getting the COVID-19 vaccine. There's some reason to think that NSAIDs might diminish the effectiveness of the vaccine, but they're not sure. They don't have very good data on whether NSAIDs diminish the effectiveness of the vaccine. And some experts wanted to say, well, yes, NSAIDs, you know, are going to undermine the vaccine. Therefore, don't take NSAIDs a week before or a week after you get vaccinated. Other experts said, it's okay to take them before, but don't take them after. And other experts said, go ahead and take NSAIDs. And they all sounded confident. And they all sounded like their opinion was the only opinion out there. You didn't get much discussion of the expert disagreement. The experts, in fact, disagreed. But they all expressed their own opinion as if it was the only opinion.
The question I don't know is, what were the people in the clinical trials, were they free to take any painkillers they wanted, or were they instructed not to take any other drugs during the trial? So that would be pretty compelling if we were told, look, the Participants in the clinical trials were instructed not to take any over-the-counter painkillers. And so we don't know whether these vaccines will be 95% effective if people do, or if maybe the people in the trials were not told anything. And so, you know, some of them might've taken them just like some people in the general public will be taking them. And so I could see how, there's a lot of, there are some pieces of information that are missing too.
Yeah, I think the side that said, go ahead and take NSAIDs probably thought in their, you know, probably told their own family, if you can, don't take NSAIDs. Maybe it'll help, maybe it won't help. It certainly won't do any harm. So why not maximize the odds that the vaccine will be maximally effective? I think they were telling people to go ahead and take NSAIDs because they didn't want people to have bad side effects, painful side effects, and tell their friends and family, you know, oh God, I got vaccinated and it was awful. In order to encourage vaccination, they didn't want to discourage painkillers, particularly post-vaccination, because they wanted the vaccines to be as painless as possible.
Yes.
So I think that influenced their advice, perhaps more than it influenced their own behavior. It would be nice to do a study of asking experts whether when they got vaccinated they took NSAIDs, and I'll bet you nearly all of them didn't.
Either they didn't. And also one of the things that seems to be pretty well known now is that a lot of people feel pretty sick a day or so after they get the vaccine, but that the symptoms go away fast. And so they might be tempted to take acetaminophen or one of those drugs, but within a few hours they actually feel better without taking anything. And so just telling people, well, these are symptoms that are likely to be pretty short-lived, so don't worry too much. You're not going to feel, it's not like when you're sick where this is the beginning of a week of something. This will probably only last 24 hours and then you're good to go. So don't worry too much about it. And
whatever their motives, I think what's interesting here in terms of the initial question is some experts said take NSAIDs,
yes.
Some experts said don't take NSAIDs. They all sounded like they knew, and they all sounded like there's nobody out there with a different opinion.
Yes.
And that's the second pattern. The third pattern is nasty debate. Both sides are active, and instead of ignoring each other, they diss each other. They represent the other side as foolish or harmful or behind in the data or ideological or somehow just wrong. And that's characteristic, for example, of the debate between aerosol transmission and droplet transmission. There are experts who think it's mostly aerosol and therefore ventilation is the most important precaution. There are experts who think it's mostly droplets and therefore, big droplets, and therefore social distancing is the most important precaution. They are not, for the most part, ignoring each other. They are attacking each other, in many cases, in quite nasty ways. They misrepresent each other's opinion. Each of them represents the other side as absolutist and ignoring, my half of the data. That's the third pattern is nasty debate. And we've seen a lot of that. The fourth pattern is the most dangerous, in my judgment. And that's a strong and largely successful effort to shut down the minority opinion. Where there is a majority opinion and there's a minority opinion that's large enough that it's worthwhile. And it's not just a couple of crazy people. It's a real minority opinion among genuine experts. And the profession unites against not just against the minority opinion, but against anybody getting to hear the minority opinion. You saw that, for example, with the Great Barrington Declaration, at least some of the people behind the Great Barrington Declaration are thoroughly qualified experts. who had, you know, whether they expressed it in a little bit less nuanced way than I would have advised them to express it. What they were saying, in essence, was, was a real opinion, a real expert minority opinion about the relative importance of two different overarching strategies toward managing the pandemic.
Right, right. So reaction, just to back up, because some people sort of may have heard of the Great Barrington Declaration, but forgotten what it was. So that this was the idea that instead of everybody equally taking precautions, that we really focus all the precautions on the most vulnerable, which we know are older people, and go ahead and let younger people keep the economy going, stay in school, do what they do, and develop herd immunity, because very few of them will be seriously ill. And then that will make the situation less dangerous for the older people once all the younger people have had the disease, or many of them, and there will just be less disease around at some point, then all the older people can stop having to shelter in place. So would that be a reasonable summary of the Great Barrington Declaration idea?
Yeah. I mean, the strategy we've mostly settled on for vaccination is to vaccinate the vulnerable people first. And that, you know, before we had vaccines, protect the vulnerable people mostly, and let the people whose exposure to the disease is unlikely to kill them, protect them much less, put much less focus on reducing the number of cases, and much more focus on protecting the people whose cases are likeliest to land them in the hospital or land them in the morgue. And, you know, it's debatable, and I'm a risk communication person. I'm sort of not entitled to a voice in that very complicated technical debate. But what's interesting from a risk communication point of view is the majority side shut the minority side down, or at least did everything it could to shut the minority side down. And, you know, there were efforts by colleagues to get censure resolutions through academic faculty senates. There were efforts to get social media to cancel websites that advocated this approach to the pandemic. And it's not just the Great Barrington Declaration. Questions of at what level herd immunity is achieved, questions of under what circumstances schools should be opened, questions of whether Sweden is a good guy or a bad guy.
Yeah.
There are a number of questions where there was a real majority opinion and a real minority opinion, and the minority opinion got shut down, or at least every effort was made to shut down the minority opinion. And if you've studied sort of, you know, the development of science, the history of science, or if you've read Kuhn and others on scientific paradigms and how they change, this is not all that surprising, but it is horrifying. Minority opinions are the cutting edge of scientific progress. The way science progresses is with people who think the mainstream is wrong. And of course, most of the people who think the mainstream is wrong turn out wrong. But the ones who turn out right are the cutting edge of progress. And that's most obviously important in a crisis, you know, when we really, really want mistaken paradigms to get corrected as soon as possible. So the last thing you want to do in a crisis is get a premature consensus and censor the minority opinions that might turn out to be the next paradigm and the important new understanding that's going to save thousands and thousands of lives.
I don't know the details of the Great Barrington Declaration, so I think the people who don't like it say, oh, it's basically encouraging people to get the disease. But I wasn't clear on whether it was in fact allowing younger people to have more freedom, with the understanding, you know, that they understood there was some risk. They could get long COVID, they could get a serious case, you know, that they were going to be allowed to choose their own risk as opposed to being lied to that there is no risk to them, which would be a very different thing. And so I don't really know whether the Great Barrington Declaration was founded on letting people choose their own risk, but being very honest and clear with them that, yes, there is still some risk to young people.
I mean, it's a two-page document, you know, and I think you can make a very good case that it isn't as clear as it should have been, or as it ideally would have been, that there are downsides to this strategy, just as there are downsides to the majority strategy. And I'd need to look again before I opined on whether they acknowledged that, you know, of course, you know, if millions of young, healthy people get COVID, some of them are going to get sicker than they would have wanted to get. And a few of them, or some of them are going to die, or some of them are going to have long COVID. I don't know to what extent they acknowledge that this is not a cost-free option. But their dominant argument was that it's a better option than shutting down the whole society. And that argument did not get a fair hearing because the minority opinion among the experts didn't want it to get a fair hearing.